California residents who were concerned about fire in our urban-wildland interface. People came from fire-prone areas all around Northern California, including paradise. One person we heard from that weekend was Native American Valentin Lopez, chairman of the Amamutsun people of the Santa Cruz Mountains. He talked to us for nearly 2 hours about his people and their culture. I'm going to play a short excerpt where he talked about the cultural use of fire.
Whenever we have a cultural burn, you guys, you know, call them prescribed burns. We call them cultural burns. They're very important for our culture. You know, whenever we have a fire, a controlled burn, it serves a lot of purposes. It goes through, it just creeps along. It's a very low intensity fire, and it just kind of creeps along the ground. You know, we go through and we trim the branches, anything where the gets you to climb up the trees and stuff like that. We clip all that stuff down. And then we have the fire, and it just kind of crawls through slowly. But when it's going through slowly, it's killing the tips and the fleas and other pests like that in the ground. And then that smoke, when it goes up, I said that, you know, whenever we pray, we always say, you know, we have fire and smoke. Well, this right here is a way of cleansing and blessing the trees. Because whenever that smoke goes up into the trees, it's smudging the trees, it's blessing the trees, and they're cleansing the trees. And that smoke goes up and chokes out the insects that are in the trees, and those insects fall down. And so now you have a much healthier tree there, particularly the acorns. And so it's cleansing and blessing them and cleaning them. And, you know, when it's part of, and this right here is needed, we talk about historic trauma. Those trees had historic trauma. And this is a way of bringing spirituality back to the trees and back to the landscape. You know, if we're going to restore these lands, and we believe the restoration of Mother Earth must be led by indigenous people, because only indigenous people have the moral authority. Creator gave us that obligation. You know, our evidence must last 7 generations. So you know, the whole issue of climate change and stuff like that must be indigenous-led. We totally firmly believe that. And it's not going to be indigenous knowledge only. It's going to be blending the sciences with the indigenous knowledge, but it must be indigenous-led. But those fires, you know, they're so important, and they just creep along. And in the old days, our people, they would light the landscapes. They could tell weather much better than we can today. And they knew if the rains were 2 days out or 3 days out, they said, well, we want 3 days of burns. And there goes the burns. And then they have certain kinds of burns for the medicine plants, for the food plants. And we're working with the Klamath and the Yurok tribe now also on sharing indigenous knowledge. You know, the guy picks up a leaf and he lights it. And he goes, if you burn now, you're going to get a 4-foot fire. You know, and then I saw him work that other time. He goes, you burn now, you're going to have a 2-foot fire. You know, they just have that indigenous knowledge, and that's the indigenous knowledge that said that we're trying to get knowledge from our neighboring tribes, and that's the kind of knowledge that we're trying to bring back.
I'm at delivering updates of the campfire recovery effort right here at KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico.
Mountain Kabado grills, wood, gas, pellet stoves,
including Loki, FPX, Hearth products, to celebrate a clean, beautiful, and heartwarming gathering place. You can find White Gloves House of Fire at 3128 Thorntree Drive in Chico and at whitegloveschimney.com. I also want to remind you that the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views of our opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. So, Blake, how are you doing today?
Recovering.
Yeah.
Recovering.
From the mono, yeah. Like we said last week, I hate to repeat the joke, but it seems that I need to. It's good to have you moving in stereo again. Why don't you introduce the topic for today? What's the big idea?
Today we want to talk about a really common issue in a lot of communities in California, and frankly across the United States. There's this wonderful little program called Housing Choice Voucher Program, which is administered by HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department. It's better called Section 8, and unfortunately, most places across the country just don't deal with it. So if you're in a war with this money, if landlords won't even consider your application, it doesn't do any good. So one thing we want to talk about is what communities have done to address this issue, because people who are on Section 8 are often some of our most vulnerable people with children, people taking in elderly, people with disabilities, and of course, people with low income.
Right. And I can speak personally to this because I am a recipient of the Housing Choice Voucher, and I've been on the program for about 5 years, I want to say. And when I finally got the voucher, it took about 2 to 4 years to get the voucher itself, just being on the waiting list, and you had to fill out paperwork annually, and, you know, there's this continuous threat of if you don't do the right thing, you're going to be kicked off the waiting list. So that's thing number one, and then thing number two, when you finally get the voucher, they give you this list of maybe 5 to 10 places, apartment complexes, facilities owned by private landlords that accept Section 8. Now, I was lucky in my case because I already had an apartment that was generously, I had a co-signer, and somebody helped me, you know, apply and pay the deposit and get the apartment. And fortunately for me, the complex already already accepted Section 8. So, I was fortunate, and then it's like, okay, I'm already living here. All I have to do is get the landlord to accept the voucher. This paperwork says they're going to accept the voucher. Bing, bang, boom. It wasn't bing, bang, boom, but it was a relatively easy process relative to the process that I think other people might go through and do go through. Because my understanding is that the list of landlords that accept Section 8 has actually gone down in the past 5 years. Is that your general understanding as well, Blake?
Well, it has certainly gone down, but every new addition to Chico in terms of housing has not been open to it. So rather, it's stayed flat. So as housing has slowly increased, it hasn't increased for people who are on Section 8.
Yeah, and it's like you said, I mean, these are people that are in poverty and struggling, and they need all the help they can get. They don't need additional barriers to housing. And this is a problem. We need to do something to address it. And other cities and counties have addressed it. So they've addressed it with ordinances that protect against income source discrimination. That's a little complicated to explain, and Blake, you've been doing research on this longer than I have, so why don't you
make it the layman's version of things.
Well, what they mean when they say protections against discrimination of sources of income is it doesn't matter. Well, it doesn't matter to a degree how you pay that rent, or rather, not how, but rather who pays that rent.
Right, where the income's coming from.
Where the income's coming from, to a degree. Most of these ordinances have an exception. They exclude income that comes from illegal activities.
Right.
Obviously, that's an exemption. But they make clear that, hey, if this person is paying the rent through a government or nonprofit administered assistance program, you can't reject the application outright. Now, these ordinances require them to accept the applications. All these ordinances do is allow these applications to be considered. Puts them on a level playing field.
Yeah, it gives them the chance to get to that step where, you know, you have the criteria barrier and all the other barriers that come along with it. So it's just like, it's an important step to take, and that's why we're discussing it here. But really, these are just small reformist steps that we can take. But I think this is an important one. Just like any progress is non-linear, you know, it goes back and forth. But any progress we can make has to happen, I think, in small reformist steps. And this is a good small reformist step, and a step that I think, with enough mobilization in the Butte County and Northern California area, we can take locally.
A lot of cities you see that have adopted norms like this are cities like Berkeley, San Francisco, these big area cities. Other places that adopted norms like this include Woodland, which is, you know, a small rural community.
Yeah, I didn't see Woodland on the list there. That's shocking, because I would think, Woodland's relatively isolated, not even really a suburb of Sacramento, but it's like Woodland is different from us in that they are more rural, and I would assume more conservative as well. I'm not sure about that though. So I want to go over some facts here that we're kind of looking at. As we've said, many cities nationwide have enacted source of income anti-discrimination ordinances that prohibit landlords from rejecting potential tenants that have rental assistance. There's actually a state bill that's been proposed, Senate Bill 329. Has been proposed in the California State Senate. This bill would prohibit landlords from discriminating against those getting rental assistance by redefining legal source of income, verifiable sources of income paid to a housing owner or landlord on behalf of the tenant, including federal, state, or local public assistance and housing subsidies as specified. So that's a little complicated, but it's basically there's already anti-discrimination laws in place for a variety of that give people a variety of protections on the basis of applying to be a tenant. But this is just expanding that regulation further and basically amending the law to include this new definition. That's probably about as clear as mud. But I tried. I really did. So that's what we're looking at on a state level and a local level. I really hope that people, we need to discuss this more, obviously, but I really hope that people kind of think about this as a possibility, because we're in such a dark housing crisis that it needs to be addressed. Go ahead, buddy.
And this is more pressing now more than ever because of the Camp Fire, the housing authority, the Butte County Housing Authority has received additional vouchers to provide to victims of the campfire. And one of the downsides with the Section 8 program is once you're awarded the voucher, you have a very limited time span to find housing.
Absolutely.
Typically, that's 60 days. So when the lottery happens, which I believe is at the end of this month, April, you have 60 days to find a place to live. And I think it's important that within the next month or two, preferably as soon as possible, that Chico open the housing market to this class of people, people who are taking care of their parents, people who are taking care of their children, people who have disabilities or who are low income.
Yeah, it's, you know, as we keep saying, it's the most vulnerable section of the population that we're talking about here. And, you know, it doesn't say it in my notes, but do you know how many vouchers that it's a grant that's being given as part of the emergency response?
I can't say precisely. The Housing Authority didn't specify on their website, but I imagine it's substantial considering, well, how to put this, it's a pretty big housing crisis. I imagine HUD wouldn't skimp out on the campfire.
Yeah, one would hope, anyway. So I'm glad that HUD is, because for a long time on their website, HUD said, you know, we can't, we're not a resource right now to give people housing that are displaced by the campfire unless you already have the voucher and just have been displaced and you've lost your home. I'm glad that they're finally able to have the resources to be able to do something about this. That's a good thing. And I'm going to skip ahead in my notes here so I can tell you a little bit more about from the behavioral, or not the behavioral, but the job was my brain. From the Butte County Housing Authority website, the Housing Authority of Butte County has scheduled an opening of a special Section 8 waitlist for campfire survivors. The waitlist will be open from 4-1, so April 1st, to 4-30, so the 30th of this month. Verification that your household was displaced by the campfire will be required in order to be placed on the waitlist. For more information, visit Butte-housing.com. So if you're out there and you've been displaced by the campfire and you're low income, that's your resource to turn to Butte-housing.com.
And let me specify, this program, Section 8, isn't just the program's for low-income people, but they give preference for people who are taking care of their parents, who have children, or have a disability. So if you fall into one of those categories, please apply.
Yeah, absolutely. I really hope. I'd love to hear from some people. Obviously, it takes a while to, you know, get on the wait list, and then the lottery is drawn, so you don't know what number you're going to get on the wait list. But when people go through that process, I'd love to hear from them and to see what their experience is like. You can reach me, NICHOLAS Jackson, JACKSON, at KZFR.org. If you'd like to leave feedback about this process or anything that we're talking about on the show today. So I want to kind of, we had two city council meetings in a row, which is rather intense and unusual. So I want to cover that. But like here, let's specify what people can do specifically if they like the idea of a housing ordinance that would protect people against source of income discrimination. Is it a matter of just, you know, reaching out to city councilors and getting on the agenda, or how should people go about that?
I think the best way would be to get in contact with a member of our city council and tell them you'd like to see some work done at ordinance. protect people who rely on mental assistance.
Yeah, and don't forget, there's also the Senate bill. So call your assemblyman, call your state senator. That's also a good way to get this taken care of and addressed. And I get the feeling that we're going to be talking about this more as time goes on. But I really do want to get to city council stuff. So that's going to wrap it up for the big idea portion of the show. Again, if you have feedback, nichollaskatson at kzfr.org is my email address. And, yeah, let's move on to city council stuff. So, like, since you were sick, you weren't at the Orange Street shelter discussion, so I will cover that part. Orange Street shelter would be a collaboration between the Jesus Center, Safe Space, and Torah Shelter Resources as well. And it's a going to be housed in, it's proposed to be housed in a warehouse near the train station in Depot Park, which is sort of downtown adjacent, which is why Chico First people are upset about it, or part of the reason why they're upset about it. Capacity of 100 beds, partly funded by a grant from Walmart as a part of the Campfire Disaster Relief effort. 24/7 service, capacity of 100 beds. They're working in tandem with Beat Behavioral Health. That's where my brain was coming earlier. So that's a good thing, because a lot of people that are that don't have socially appropriate housing do struggle with mental illness issues, so that's a good thing. And they also struggle with medical issues, so there's going to be a pilot medical program run in tandem with this Orange Street shelter run by Mental Health. And the, let's see what else. The biggest thing on this is there were 75 speaker cards at the city council meeting, and there was no action to be taken by the city council. It was purely just a place for public comment, but it got really heated and really intense, and you could see the divide in the room between people that are upset by homelessness and don't want to meet homeless people's needs, and people that care about people that are homeless and want to meet homeless people's needs. And it was, you know, it's, to me, it signifies how divided our community is against on this issue. And I have a friend that really is into empathy and trying to connect people and heal these gaps, and I think this is definitely an issue where we need to look at this as a community and try and see if we can bridge the gap between these polar opposites in desires on what to do with the homelessness. So that is, in brief, the Orange Street shelter issue. It'll go to the Planning Commission if the action is appealed, and let's face it, it will be. So that's kind of the next step in this process, but I think there's a genuine effort by housing service or homeless services in our community to want to see this succeed and to want to see more services for those without shelter. So that's a rather long-winded take on it, but do you have any comments, Blake?
Well, I've been told by one of my interns that the university is also opposed to this project, which is interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting and unfortunate. I heard about the letter. I hadn't seen it, but I heard about it.
But besides that, well, I guess what it really comes down to is the location more than anything.
Yeah.
Downtown adjacent. It's close to
university. It's close to the downtown business area,
close to schools.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the big ambitions of a lot of downtown businesses is to frankly push the homeless people out of that area to some fringe corner of the community, if not just outside Jacob in general.
Right. Well, and I get the feeling that, again, the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR and staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers, but I get the feeling that Go First would do what actually some cities have done and elect to get all the people without shelter together, send them, get them on a bus, and just ship them out of town. That's the feeling I get based on the city council proceedings and the public comment I've heard, which is, you can't do that. You just can't do that. You have to deal with the issue. But go ahead, Blake. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I hesitate to go there, but I can see your perspective based on what I've seen from prior council meetings. The comments can be pretty gun-ho in the attitude, pretty brazen.
Yeah.
For lack of a better word.
So struggling with the words today. These issues are so intense. And, you know, it's funny. I thought covering local politics would be easier because it's less controversial. But I was wrong.
Well, you actually thought that.
Yeah, I did think that. Naive and stupid.
It's the opposite. Yeah, it's a bit more controversial than my backyard.
Yeah, that's true. NIMBY is not my backyard, yeah. So, let's see. Briefly, the price housing ordinance was passed by a vote of 7-0 last night. So, that's a good thing. Anti-price gouging ordinance.
No one abstained even.
No one abstained.
Bless his heart. His heart grew two sizes up that day.
Yeah. I was surprised by the unanimous vote. And there were, by that time of the night, it was rather late, so there were only 3 speaker cards. One of which was against, and it was kind of a let the free market take care of this.
That wasn't Barry.
No, it wasn't Barry. No, it wasn't. I forget who it was. I should have noted it down. But the problem with these cities, I'm very much in favor of the price gouging ordinance. We need this in the shadow of Campfire, all the other things that have taken place. It was another intense city council meeting, and unfortunately these things go on for so long that you can't cover it in 15 minutes. So we're up against the clock. Hopefully we've given you some ideas to think about. Again, if you have feedback for me, nicholaschjcksonkzfr.org. I'd love to hear your feedback. And I also want to cover the Pancakes for Peace event that's coming up this weekend. Don't miss it. April 21st, come out and have a great time. Celebrate Easter egg hunt, pancakes, of course. For information on that, search Facebook for Chico Peace and Justice Center. And we are at that point here where we've got to get out of here, but I thank you so much for listening to The Big Idea. Don't forget to tip the show, kzfr.org, and we'll be back next week. Stay tuned for Non-Human Radio coming up next. Festival is one of the best local events of the year. Get your tickets now.
And Non-Human Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by OWN Foods, serving organic, non-GMO whole foods, including wild-caught mahi-mahi, and having the largest vegan menu in downtown Chico. OWN Foods serves homemade teas and lemonade, acai bowls and smoothies blended with coconut water, and they're located at 142 Broadway, just 2 blocks from Chico State. They're open Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. and on Saturday from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. with to-go and catering available. For more info, go to iloveomfoods.com or find them on Facebook. And Non-Human Radio is also made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR, supporters like you, and by Peterson Tree Care, because trees need care. John Peterson continues his family tradition of caring for Chico's amazing natural resource. Licensed, bonded, and insured, with financing available, Peterson Tree Care handles residential and commercial properties and can be reached by calling 518-0924. This is KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Non-Human Radio.